Author Kirk Johnson is with us this morning to tell us about his new book, The Feather Thief, which explores the 2009 theft of rare Victorian-era bird feathers from a British museum by American music student Edwin Rist, who was obsessed with using the feathers for exotic fishing lures. Johnson joins us this morning to discuss the book and his own obsession with Rist's story, which grew as Johnson tried to escape the pressures of his nonprofit, The List Project. Again, the name of the book is The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. And we welcome Kirk Johnson to the program this morning. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
A great pleasure to have you on the program. I love this book so much. I'm a big fan of the quirky, and this is
full of it.
It is full of quirkiness, and I love it. Tell the story about how you found out about this in the first place.
Yeah, well, so in my previous life, I was in charge of the reconstruction of the city of Fallujah in Iraq for the U.S. government, and in the course of that work, I became close with a lot of Iraqis who were risking their lives on our behalf as interpreters alongside U.S. Marines and soldiers and diplomats. And when I got back to the States, I realized that many of them were now running for their lives because they're seen as traitors for helping us. And I started an organization that fought to get them visas because I felt that that was the least that we owed them for their service. That kind of naively, I thought maybe I'd, you know, win that battle in a year or two. I was in my mid-20s, so I kind of had the folly of youth. But after nearly a decade of my life, I realized that if I wasn't careful, I was going to spend the rest of my life trying to push these cases through the bureaucracy, and I was frankly just getting burnt out. And the only way that I really could clear my mind was by fly fishing. You know, when you get up into a mountain stream, your cell phone signal tends to die out, and the only thing that really matters at that point is how good you are at identifying insect hatches on the river and paying attention to kind of the subtleties of what's happening around you. And it was during one of these sort of escapist fishing outings in northern New Mexico that my fly fishing guide just mentioned this crazy story about an American kid that broke into the British Museum, made off with 299 bird skins, and these are not like the public displayed skins where the wings are outstretched. They're like very compact. The wings are tied up close to the body. Brought him back to his dorm room at the Royal Academy of Music, where he was studying as a flautist, and began to pluck the feathers, which he sold for, I think, the British authorities estimated it at about $250,000 worth, partly to make a lot of money, partly to buy a new golden flute. I mean, I was hearing all of this, and it just seemed so strange as to be, like, unbelievable. And so I started poking around at first just to see if it was all just, you know, sort of gossipy exaggeration. But what I found out was not only that it was true, but that it was a lot crazier than that.
The incredible thing about this story is that, there's so many incredible things about the story, but you find out about it, and then you yourself become obsessed with it. You just find this and find it to be absolutely fascinating, which it is. So when the investigation starts on your part, where do you even begin with it?
I had never written a book at this point. I had no clue how one starts or conducts an investigation for missing museum birds. What I had was a kind of intuitive sense or kind of a gut sense that justice had been denied. And so that was initially what kind of animated me, but really, I mean, I logged into these forums, these Victorian salmon fly tying forums, and starting from zero knowledge, I just started printing things out and making timelines, and then I realized whenever I found like a juicy piece of evidence or something particularly incriminating, like one of the bird skin sales or a pack of feathers for sale, and I printed them out, I noticed things started disappearing, and they'd be deleted from the forum. And what really began as a side hobby, and I mean, I'm not kidding, I would testify before Congress, and then I would go back to my hotel room and log into these forums and take screenshots of things. But what began as sort of this side hobby, where I was essentially just doing a dragnet operation of interviewing everyone who would talk to me, and then I'd find out if one guy didn't like another guy in the community, and I'd get him to flip on the other one and give me damning intel. And before I knew it, I had, you know, a mountain of evidence, and slowly started drawing a net around the feather thief. But it did take me 3.5 years to convince him to agree to talk to me, which he did in a single 8.5-hour interview in Dusseldorf, Germany. He's never spoken to anyone before or since about what he did that night and what happened. But I still, looking back after all these years, there's times where I still just can't believe that this happened. It's just so weird.
It is, but it is fascinating. So you go back, I mean, this story dates back more than a century. 1854, yeah. Alfred Russel Wallace is a British naturalist. He starts to go to collect these various species, and then he returns to England with over 8,000 tropical bird skins and more than 100,000 insects. Now, let us then skip to 1895, where The Salmon Fly, which is a book by George Kelson, is published, which becomes the fly-tying Bible for generations with these. Are they called recipes? I would think they'd be instructions, but they're recipes.
Yep.
And recipes on how to make a fly that would catch the salmon, correct?
Exactly. Well, the one qualification is that this is another layer of absurdity, but salmon are essentially colorblind when they're spawning, and they're just striking at things out of aggression because they're trying to protect the eggs that they've just laid.
Right.
So you could just as easily catch a salmon with a tuft of dog fur on a hook. So there is no real biology behind any of this. There's no reason why a salmon in Scotland should prefer a king bird of paradise feather from New Guinea.
So, but the point is that you could get more money for a fly using these feathers than you could if you had one made out of a schnauzer.
Yeah, that's true. But even to complicate it even further, most of the guys who do this have no idea how to fish. They just tie these things as a kind of aesthetic creation, and in many cases, they just sit in drawers in their own tying rooms or dens for their own kind of obsessive collections. There's a lot of like status and prestige in being able to say that you've tied one of these flies. I mean, one of them called the Chatterer requires $2,000 worth of feathers, which are rarely available. And in some cases, some of these flies do call for feathers from species of protected birds. So this is all about a game of prestige and status around scarce things.
You know,
and that's what led him to break in that night.
When I read, as I was reading the story, that was one thing that really surprised me, that you would think that the people who are going to do this, that are going to go to this length, would do it because they were the ones who would want to fish, or they were the ones who were going to want to, you know, sort of give these to the community. But that's not the case.
No. I mean, I think the feather thief, he won a fly tying contest a few years into his devotion. I think he was a teenager at that point, and the prize was a fly rod. And he said he had no idea what to do with it. Like, and I don't think he ever even used it. I mean, I would have killed for that fly rod that he won. But this is really all about just an art form, and it's one of the only art forms I can think of that drives its adherents into breaking the law almost as soon as you start out with it. A lot of these guys just have a pretty big moral blind spot where they think that their devotion to these beautiful things justifies their use of these feathers. And you can go on eBay right now and search for resplendent quetzal, which is an endangered species, and you can find fly tyers buying and selling it for, I think there's, you can buy a pair of feathers for $100.
Wow.
It's a really kind of sad thing, and I don't mean to condemn the whole community, because there's a lot of guys that saw this for what it was and don't use these rare feathers, but they're up against a century plus of men who have forked over a lot of money to buy these exotic things, and they're not going to give it up easily.
I want to let you know that I could talk to you for 8 hours on this subject, but unfortunately we only have about three or four minutes. But so let me try to, I'm just going to barrel away a bunch of questions to you. So the young man involved here is Edwin Rist. As you mentioned, he's from New York City. He's a student. He's in London, and he has the opportunity to go into the museum, into the Tring, and under false pretenses, ultimately, right? And that's how he finds these feathers. How is he able to walk out with 8,000 bird skins?
So he initially wrote to the museum saying that he was a student photographer there to take photos of the birds of paradise on behalf of a friend who was doing a dissertation on them. The museum trusted him, gave him access, and he used that first opportunity as a window of time to case the place. And he took photos of the entry and exit points and the hallways and sort of made a map of how he would eventually do it 8 months later. He stole, in the end, the number he stole was 299 bird skins, but those skins have, you know, tens of thousands of feathers on them.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the value is something, I put it at around $1 million worth of birds. But that he returned about 8 months later with an empty suitcase, a diamond blade glass cutter, wire cutters, latex gloves, a little LED flashlight, scaled the wall running behind the museum, snipped away the barbed wire and broke his way in. And very methodically, roamed the hallways, emptying drawer after drawer of these species of birds that are irreplaceable. I mean, you can't go back and get one of Wallace's birds from 1854 again. It's
right.
Once it's gone, it's gone. And he managed to crawl back out the window and drag his suitcase down this sort of unpaved dirt road back to the train station. He had missed his last train back to London that night, so he spent the night about a mile away from the museum just trying to stay awake with this $1 million full of dead birds, hoping that the cops wouldn't find him before he got out of there.
He's arrested about a year and a half later, and they only recover half of the skins from his apartment. The rest have already been sold. But and not to give away the end of the book, but I just to put a cap on our story, it is, I think, interesting for our listeners to know that he never served a day in jail for this.
Yep, that's true. And that was another thing that, you know, frankly, made me pretty upset about this whole thing. That and it's in the book, but he, through some very fancy lawyering, managed to avoid spending a night behind bars. And just by way of a little contrast, 6 months after he received what they call a suspended sentence, no prison, another guy by the name of Darren Bennett broke into the exact same museum and sawed off a rhino horn, except that the museum had anticipated that rhino horn might be stolen because there was this international crime syndicate stealing rhino horn. So they had already replaced that rhino horn with a plaster replica. So the guy who stole it actually made off with, you know, a few pounds of plaster, and for that he spent 2 years of his life behind bars. And so just to give you a sense, I mean, this, I mean, the British Museum of Natural History director described this, what Edwin did, as a catastrophic theft from humanity, that these skins can never be replaced, and they likely held answers to questions that scientists haven't even thought to ask yet. We have no idea what answers we might be able to extract from these collections in 100 years or 200 years. I mean, you've got to recognize, like, these birds have been protected not just against the ravages of time or of insects, but, I mean, they were protected from Hitler's Luftwaffe. They were secreted out of London in a fleet of unmarked trucks to this rural museum town where they've been protected since then. I mean, they have an incredible legacy,
Kirk,
and unfortunately, they're never going to be replaced.
You have to go, I know, and but I'm hoping you'll come back. I'll be in touch, and you come back, and you have to tell me more about this story. It was really incredible.
I'd be honored.
The name of the book is The Feather Thief. Kirk Johnson is the author. The book is just delightful and incredible. It's out from Viking. Kirk, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it was a real pleasure.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, The Feather Thief by Kirk Wallace Johnson. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.